From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. On today's show, saxophonist and composer Matana Roberts uses her family as inspiration for a sprawling musical project called Coin Coin. Matana Roberts and her band will perform in the studio. Also, families play a big role in one of author Amy Tan's most successful novels, The Joy Luck Club. Her latest book is called The Valley of Amazement. She'll talk about exploring the world of Shanghai courtesans in the early 1900s, and she'll share a Pick 3 playlist with us. But first, could there be a more well-known jazz figure than Duke Ellington? Prolific composer, tireless performer, ubiquitous cultural presence, and yet a new biography argues that no one, even those ostensibly closest to him, really knew the person behind the showman. Terry Teachout is a drama critic for the Wall Street Journal and the author of the critically acclaimed Louis Armstrong biography, Pops. His latest book is Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. Terry, welcome back to Soundcheck.
It's always good to be here, John.
Your book begins in medias res, you know, in the middle of things. Great, ploy for fiction and nonfiction alike. You chose to begin with Duke Ellington's 1943 debut at Carnegie Hall.
Right.
Because it seems to sum up everything that was great and everything that was so frustrating about Duke Ellington.
And everything characteristic, too. A guy who was the world's greatest procrastinator, who did everything at the last minute, including writing the piece of music for his Carnegie Hall debut. And when you read about this, I mean, how he really did put it off until, I think, something like 6 weeks before they opened. And this is black, brown, and beige, the clinching large-scale work of his middle years. And he just starts writing it, you know, backstage at a theater. And the ink is still wet when they premiere it at Carnegie Hall.
And he knows what this means because you write in the book that he was sort of, you know, flustered about Benny Goodman beating him to Carnegie Hall a couple of years earlier.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, Ellington was very conscious of the importance of publicity and of his place in the great scheme of jazz. And it was a very big thing for him finally to come to Carnegie Hall and to write this major, large-scale work.
So a big thing, but just not big enough to really worry about it 2 months, 3 months ahead of the game.
Yeah, though he got a little nervous toward the end, I think.
All right, all you procrastinators out there, here's a man after your own heart, Duke Ellington, with the 1943 piece that he debuted at Carnegie Hall, called Black, Brown, and Beige. From Black, Brown, and Beige, Duke Ellington's kind of standard-bearing, long-form piece that he debuted at Carnegie Hall in 1943 that is recounted by my guest, Terry Teachout, in the new book called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. Now, most biographers come to biography because they're either big fans or they have an agenda and want to, like, skew it. You seem to be a huge fan of Duke Ellington, but you don't cut this guy any slack.
Well, I think the greatest – Duke Ellington is a genius, the key composer in the history of jazz. And the greatest tribute that you can pay to a great man is to tell the truth about him.
It's really striking. You think of, the amount of womanizing that this guy did.
It's awe-inspiring, to tell you the truth.
And nobody – there's not a sniff of it in the gossip columns. I mean, you think of, like, Facebook and Instagram and Twitter these days, the guy wouldn't have stood a chance.
It's quite a thought. I mean, especially the fact that he remained married to the same woman from the 20s through her death in the 60s, but they weren't living together after the late 20s, and with good reason, since she took a knife to him one night.
And there is the cover photograph. You see the scar
on the left side
of Duke Ellington's face.
And it's very unusual to get a photograph like this. Stephen Lasker, the great Ellington collector, who helped me a lot with this book, found this photo. There's no makeup. Usually Ellington used stage makeup so that you couldn't see the scar. So this is the best photograph either of us has ever seen of the scar.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Ellington took a razor to her husband in bed one night.
When she found out that
he was
he'd been catting around.
Yeah.
So was it hard? I mean, as you say, he was almost maddening in the circumlocutions that he would use or the absolute evasions that he would use.
Yeah.
So how did you find all this stuff?
Well, basically, you know Ellington through what other people say. There's no Ellington correspondence. You know, you can count the number of surviving personal letters on the fingers of one hand. There is a series of interviews that were taped in the 60s with a man who was working for Time magazine, who was thinking of doing a biography of Ellington. And they're very candid. They're not candid in the same way as, say, Louis Armstrong's private tapes are, but they're as candid as Ellington got. Beyond that, though, you are dealing with sources whose validity you've got to weigh. Fortunately, he's such a fascinating man, and so many hundreds of musicians pass through his band, that you have the enormous amounts of material to deal with. And I think there were people who loathed him, including some of his musicians. Most of them either truly admired him or had admiring but mixed feelings about him. But I think they wanted to tell the truth about him insofar as they knew it.
Now, you call the song Coco Ellington's most perfect instrumental composition. What is going on here with Ellington and his players that makes the kind of disposition of his instrumental forces so perfect?
Well, this is the key moment. It's 1940. The band has been together since 24, 25. He's been tinkering with the instrumentation, trying to find exactly the right musicians. In 1940, everything comes together when Jimmy Blanton, the great bass player, enters the band. So he's got exactly, finally, the right mix of people. He himself has developed as a composer through this period. He's got complete mastery of the three-minute instrumental form. And so he takes the simplest and most basic of all jazz forms, the blues, and writes this devastatingly concise, explosive, three-minute minor key blues. It's not really solo-driven. It is a composition, and it's just mayhem unlimited. You can just see him throwing lightning bolts all the way through it.
Song is Coco from 1940, Duke Ellington and his famous orchestra, as they were officially known back then. You talk, Terry, we're speaking with Terry Teachout, Wall Street Journal drama critic and author of the new book, Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. You said throwing lightning bolts. You know, you could sort of imagine him Zeus-like.
That's exactly what I was thinking of, yes. Up on a cloud.
But, you know, sometimes, as you write in the book, he was musically literate in his own way, but not in a conventional way. So
that's exactly right. He was completely self-taught. He had maybe half a dozen harmony lessons. He was essentially a self-taught pianist. And he believed in being self-taught, that he thought it would impair what was most distinctive about him if he tried to work his inspiration, especially into classical molds. He was mm-hmm. very specific about that.
Mm-hmm. So he was a pianist, but really the orchestra, the big band, was his instrument.
That's right. I think it was Billy Strayhorn who actually said it just like that. I think, if memory serves, Strayhorn said he plays piano, but his real instrument is the orchestra. And he was a very good, distinctive pianist. And he got better as he got older. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, what he was about was that ability to take what was in his head and translate it into the language of the band.
And sometimes to take what was in other people's heads.
Yes.
Not to put too fine a point on it.
Yes, indeed.
So, you know, the relationship between Duke Ellington, Irving Mills, his longtime manager, and his quote-unquote sidemen, people like Cootie Williams and Juan Teasel, sometimes it was hard to tell who actually was responsible for
these exactly pieces. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I think one of the things that I discovered in the course of writing this book is that Ellington, like many classical composers, like Beethoven, like Stravinsky, was not a natural writer of tunes. Mm-hmm. He's a harmonist. That's where the essence of his music is lodged, as you heard in Coco. He had people in his band who were completely natural tune writers, Johnny Hodges, the alto saxophone player, in particular. And if you look at the Ellington compositions that are the big pop hits, mm-hmm. like Mood Indigo, like Sophisticated Lady, the ones that we remember as song titles. 9 times out of 10, the melodic material was either supplied by members of the band in whole or in part. Mm-hmm. Ellington transformed that,
yeah.
But he got it from listening on the bandstand.
So a song like Caravan would be triple credited to Irving Mills and Juan Teasel, who apparently came up with the original riff, and Duke Ellington.
Right.
You mentioned Mood Indigo. Where did this come? What's the creation
of this? Boy, that's about 10 pages in the book. That really took some tracing. And we really aren't at the bottom of it. We can never really know. But Barney Bigard, the clarinetist for the mm-hmm. band, brought in a tune fragment, which is when you have the vocal version of Mood Indigo, you know, how I get that Mood Indigo. That melody is what Bigard brought in. Mm-hmm. And he may, in turn, have gotten it from a musician he knew down in New Orleans. Ellington's composition was to write his contribution was to write the introductory section, that chorale that we hear first when you hear Mood Indigo, and then to lock the pieces together in a unified whole. He's got the compositional mind that his sidemen did not have.
Mm-hmm. So the way Bartok would incorporate Hungarian folk song
exactly
into his
right.
pieces.
Exactly right.
Let's hear a little bit the original 1930 recording of Duke Ellington and Mood Indigo. Indigo, original 1930 recording from Duke Ellington and his band, the subject of Terry Teachout's new book, Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. How was this music sort of received in the wider public in the middle of the 20th century? Where was he? Put him at his place at the cultural table of the United States.
He was very big. It's easy for us to forget this, that Ellington predates the swing era.
Right.
And because he tied up early on in 26 with Irving Mills, who was a colossally energetic and bright manager and publicist, it was Mills's idea to promote him not just as another one of these black band leaders, but as a unique figure, as a composer, as somebody who is equivalent in his area to the great classical composers. And so Ellington, from the late 20s on, was seen as this special prestige figure. Mm-hmm. And that followed him throughout his whole life.
But he still had to deal with the reality of being a black man in white America, especially, you write, when they were traveling in the South.
You bet they did. And they had an extraordinarily ingenious way of dealing with it. They traveled on private train cars. Now, nowadays, you know, I mean, what's a private train car? But back then, you could rent Pullman cars, Pullman sleepers, a private car for Ellington himself. And you were, therefore, you didn't have to stay in hotels down in the South. You didn't have to find rooming houses that would take blacks. You could cook on the car. So you were, to a great extent, isolated from the horrors that were around you when you were playing in the Deep South. And you also really impressed the Southerners down there because they'd never seen anything like this, this band full of fabulously well-dressed, well-spoken, well-carried black people. And they've got a private train car. And whenever Ellington was asked about it, he would always say, oh, yes, that's the way the president travels.
We're speaking with Terry Teachout, the Wall Street Journal's drama critic and author of the Louis Armstrong, the Louis Armstrong biography, Pops. The new book is Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. You write about diminuendo and crescendo in blue from the Newport Jazz Festival in 1956. Yeah. What is so crucial about this?
Well, it was the second great turning point in Ellington's career. This is after World War II. The big band era is over. It's really hard for surviving big bands to make a living. Rock and roll is becoming the lingua franca of American music. And Ellington is not getting the good gigs anymore. So he's got to do something. He's got to change the game. He and George Avakian, who was producing him at Columbia Records, they arranged for him to get a high-profile gig at the Newport Jazz Festival. I think this was the third Newport Jazz Festival. It was still new. It was still hot. He sets off this bomb. You know, he plays a couple of okay tracks, a couple of okay performances. And then he pulls out of the book this extraordinary extended up-tempo blues number called Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue. It dates from 37, I think it was. And then in the middle of it, he turns Paul Gonzalez, his tenor saxophone soloist, loose on a very long solo. And the crowd goes wild. And because Columbia had it was recording the concert live, we can hear this happening. You talk about Zeus up on the cloud throwing thunderbolts. This was maybe Ellington's greatest thunderbolt. A couple of weeks later, he ends up on the cover of Time magazine. And Duke Ellington, who was in decline, suddenly becomes Duke Ellington, the hottest jazz musician of his moment.
From the Newport Jazz Festival 1956, that is Duke Ellington with Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue, as Terry Teachout was just telling us, a kind of watershed revival moment for Duke Ellington.
Too bad that wasn't filmed, because there are still photographs of the performance that show people dancing. Mm-hmm. Dancing like wild.
Well, they sound like they're levitating by the end there.
They really do. They really do.
Do we need to know all this stuff about Duke Ellington, the man, to get a better understanding of the music that he's left us?
Well, you can hear the music speaks for itself. As is true of all great art. But I think, can find your way into it in a different, maybe deeper way by knowing the man behind it. Because Ellington, he's a kind of impressionist, you know. I mean, he's writing about the world that he sees, and he's writing about his interior life. Mm-hmm. And if you understand that life, I think you're going to have a different kind of appreciation of the music, aside from the fact that it's just a really fascinating story.
It is a fascinating story. Now, that's two that you've told us in recent years, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington. Do you have an affinity for one over the other?
That's a really good question. If I were going to choose a friend, it would be Satchmo.
Okay.
And everybody agrees with that. I mean, everybody loved Satchmo. I've actually written a play about him because I'm so fascinated by him as a character, as a personality. Ellington is enigmatic. Ellington is, frankly, not trustworthy. He's somebody you might like to hang out with. He's somebody you might like to play with. He might not be somebody you'd want to do business with. Perhaps that would be one way to put it. I would very much have liked to have known him, but if I had to choose one over the other as a companion, it would certainly be Louis Armstrong.
All right. Well, there are books about both from Terry Teachout. The Louis Armstrong biography is Pops, but the new book is Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. And Terry, always great to have you with us on Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me.
A little bit of Duke Ellington's East St. Louis Tootaloo. Up next, a Pick 3 playlist from Amy Tan, the author of books like The Joy Luck Club, joins us with three of her favorite things in just a moment. And later, an in-studio performance from saxophonist and composer Matana Roberts. This is Soundcheck.
Three, that's a magic number.
Joining us for this week's Pick 3 playlist is author Amy Tan. Although she's best known for writing best-selling novels like The Joy Luck Club and The Kitchen God's Wife, she's also written an opera libretto, and she's been known to rock out as the, and I'm going to quote here, lead rhythm dominatrix with the literary garage band Rock Bottom Remainders. Her new book is called The Valley of Amazement, and Amy Tan joins me here in the Soundcheck studio. Amy, welcome back.
Good to be here again.
So fans of yours probably won't be surprised to find Valley of Amazement sort of, you know, mothers and daughters, generations, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But they might be surprised that there seems to be sort of an unexpected connection to your family's past in the backstory of this book.
I didn't know there was this mystery having to do with my grandmother. I was told she was an old-fashioned, traditional woman, quiet, stay-at-home. And I had a favorite photo sitting on my desk that inspired me as I wrote. And then I came across a book called Shanghai Love, and it was about turn-of-the-century Shanghai courtesan culture. And there was a photo of 10 women, and five of them were wearing the identical clothes of my grandmother. And suddenly I thought to myself, who was she really?
Hmm. Now, courtesan culture, I mean, this is an important part of the story of Valley of Amazement. It is what it sounds like, but then there's this kind of veneer of, you know, ritual and culture.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, essentially, you know, the oldest profession.
It was a very complex system in many ways. You know, you had levels of courtesans. You had first and second class courtesans. And there were protocols that men were supposed to follow, the main one being give money or give gifts. And the courtesans, at least during the turn of the century and before, were the ones who actually chose who were the man who would be able to go behind the curtain or the door.
Mm.
So very different. And later on, of course, it was more like prostitutes where the man could just simply choose.
Right. So was it this picture that sort of set you down the road to writing this book?
I had been writing another book for 5 years. And when I saw this photo and what it might imply, I went on a mad obsession looking for research about courtesans and to find out if it possibly could be, did women wear that costume for any other reason? You know, did women actually go to photo studios to make souvenir photos for any other reason? And I was so obsessed, I decided I just have to write about and just enter this world full time.
So was this a case of you couldn't resolve the mystery of your own grandmother to your absolute satisfaction, so you had to write a fictional kind of story?
I will never know whether my grandmother really was a courtesan unless I had her writing, you know, and saying, yes, I testify that I was. But what I wanted to do is who she might have been if she had been in that world. And that it was actually interesting for me to ask myself if my circumstances changed suddenly and I found myself having to live in a world like that, what would I do? What kind of person would I be? How would I keep my pride?
Mm.
And what skills would I use to survive? Popularity was key. How would I become popular?
And these are the sorts of questions that Violet, your main character, faces, her mother, her daughter.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
it's sort of passed down generation to generation. We're speaking with Amy Tan. So how important was music to courtesan culture, the ability of a courtesan to have a repertoire of songs?
I might have exaggerated in my book how many songs that a courtesan might have needed to become popular, but entertainment, you know, being able to recite a story or a poem or sing and play the zither or whatever was part of the art. And in fact, it was more so, emphasized more so during the mid-1800s than later, when sex was not part of the business. But you know, so that they became known as maestros, the really good ones. And they still used that term as the years went by and they really engaged in sex, but also had these entertainment skills. So I imagine that a courtesan should have had known about 10 songs, you know, really well and performed them dramatically. But my character, of course, she's going to become more popular. So she knows songs of the season and she knows tragic songs, new, you know, songs of love, you know.
And although she's been raised in Shanghai, she's half American and sees herself as a very Western.
Yes,
you know,
yes. Yeah. She's never thought of herself as Chinese until she finds out later
right.
that she is.
So, Amy, for your playlist for us, your pick three today, it actually is very much Western-based.
Yes.
First of all, do you listen to music while you write?
Always.
Really?
Always. It is a thing that puts me into the mood. And, you know, I see scenes as moods. And so I choose a piece of music, and that is the music I play over and over again, the same track. And soundtracks are great for that because they are made to be in the background and they are made to establish a mood. And so that's what I do with each of the scenes.
Well, now, you mentioned soundtrack, and one of your picks is the soundtrack to the Ang Lee film Lust, Caution,
yes.
which is set in Shanghai.
Yes, yes.
So is this something that it just seems to be part and parcel of the story of the book, The Valley of Amazement.
It is, and many of the songs there were appropriate, and there was one favorite. And I just played that over and over again. It was sort of wistful. It was kind of sexy. And so I played that, and it has violins, and it has the kind of romantic sounds that a lot of Chinese music has,
right.
stringed instruments. A sort of mournful tone to it, very romantic tone.
So from the soundtrack to the film Lust, Caution, this is Wang Chia-Chi's theme. The composer is Alexander Desplat. Wang Chia-Chi's theme by Alexander Desplat, who's become pretty well known for his film scores in Hollywood. He wrote this for the Ang Lee movie Lust, Caution, but as Amy Tan is telling us, it also serves as a kind of soundtrack for her recent writing, her newest book called The Valley of Amazement. So were you actually listening to this piece while writing?
Yeah, every day. You know, it's in the background. It's It is so rich and has a slow passion to it. There's a simplicity to it, but in the background of that piano, you hear this growing complexity of which I think it has to be there in a novel. You have to establish, you know, there's a clear theme. And
right.
In the back, there's a lot of context going on.
Well, now, the context of this new novel has some referring to it as 50 Shades of Tan.
Yeah, you know? That was my joke, actually. I originated that joke, and it was, yeah, no. I mean, I hope it's not seen as 50 Shades of Tan. I was writing this, and I was really fearful people would, you know, look at the sex as being a little too salacious. And then 50 Shades of Grey came out. And then I was afraid that people would think that I had copied some formula. I've never read the book, but whatever it was, there were a lot of women reading this book. And I thought, oh, you know, please.
So you just never bothered to get around to, if all these women are reading it and
you know, there's so little time to read books. And I heard enough, you know, there were selections read by David Sedaris and Ellen DeGeneres and things like that. And I heard it and I said, okay,
having a novel read by David Sedaris, I don't think is going to give you the
any novel. He could read my novel and come off very strange. Yeah, but I heard enough, and friends would say, oh, it's very badly written. I read the whole thing, and so I know, you know, and to, you know, we all read
I heard
reasons.
The same thing. It's like, oh, it's really badly written, but I read the whole thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing is, your writing hasn't gone in that direction in the past, and now here you are, you're talking about courtesan culture, and you have no choice. You have to open that door and walk into that room.
I wasn't going to write about it, but my first reader, who's a she's like a freelance editor, she read this, and after a few chapters, she said, "You know, it takes place in a courtesan house, and you really need to have at least something mentioned about sex. They're not playing ping pong, they're not playing Chinese checkers, you know." So I thought I do need to do that. Now, my reluctance is that people always think all my books are autobiographical. I mean, I could be a ghost telling a story and they'll think, well, how was it being a ghost?
Yeah, you when know, did so, you die? Amy?
Yeah, exactly. So everything is autobiographical. And I could imagine some readers thinking that they had a private window on my bedroom.
Well, I can see how that would be.
And being in the rock bottom remainders does not help, you know, having played a dominatrix in a rock band. Yeah.
In a rock band with Stephen King and Dave Barry and all the rest of the gang.
Yeah. Respected writers.
Now, were you musical as a kid? Did you grow up playing?
I started piano lessons when I was 5, and I took them for 15 years. So music, classical music, was a huge part of my life. I hated it, but I took the lessons, and I love it now. Uh-huh, I go to the symphony, the opera more often, far more often than I do to the movies. And that's reflected in the fact, as you know, that I wrote libretto for an opera.
For The Bonesetter's Daughter.
Yeah.
That was about 6 years ago, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that is a very different kind of writing experience, I would imagine.
It definitely is, but it is a lot having to do with mood. It has to do with scenes. It has to do with a very clear, defined acts.
Yeah.
So it has to be more defined for the composer, too. It was very collaborative. Worked with Stuart Wallace and had to know his sound world and know what each scene was and all the emotions we had to put in there.
So we actually got to hear a little bit of that opera the last time you were on Soundcheck, The Bonesetter's Daughter. What we're going to hear next, though, is back to your pick three, the Rachmaninoff Third Piano Concerto.
Yeah.
What's the mood that's established here?
It's, in some ways, it's like that soundtrack of Less Caution, because it starts off very simply with notes that are piano notes, and then it builds a little. And to me, it tells a story. It has a mood that where it's almost as though somebody very innocent goes into the world and then meets something they didn't expect, and it builds and builds, and there are moments when the person just crashes completely, is almost destroyed, gets back up again, now has this new knowledge, and goes forward, again crashes. It's sort of a Anna Karenina's story, only at the end, you know, she's doesn't fall into the train tracks. You know, there's, mm-hmm. I think, a sense of strength and hope at the end.
So this, too, could be the soundtrack for this new novel.
Yeah, absolutely. I listened to that as well a lot. I started my day with Rachmaninoff, but I also interspersed Rachmaninoff throughout the day.
Well, let's hear the opening of the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 3. You like the recording that Yefim Bronfman did with
I
the
do.
Conductor
I have
Esa-Pekka
several.
Salonen.
I have several. I have several recordings, but this is the one I love the best.
Amy Tan, picking three for us today on Soundcheck. Opening of the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 3, played by pianist Yefim Bronfman with Esa-Pekka Salonen and the Philharmonia Orchestra. Amy Tan, picking a pick three playlist for us on Soundcheck today, the author of The Joy Luck Club and The Kitchen God's Wife, the libretto for the opera The Bone Setter's Daughter. Her new book is called The Valley of Amazement, and it is out now. And, talking about how music sort of underpins so much of what you've done throughout your life, it seems.
Well, I think that music also enhanced my sense of creativity, and people are finding that out now, that music helps you not only become more, I think part of it is you see patterns. You see how things are structured, but also creatively. But also it helps you perform better. I thought to myself, is it distracting or is it helping? And I think because it gets me in the mood and it cuts out everything else, that it does enhance my performance and keeps me going because I know that it's going to continue. So I just continue.
Now, when you say performance, you mean sitting down at the typewriter and actually doing your job.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Sports players or whatever, but right. I do think creative work as well.
Well, but, you know, then there's the other part of your performance, your occasional rock band, the rock
yes,
bottom
yes,
remainders.
The sad musical side of me.
The book about the band is called Hard Listening, The Greatest Rock Band Ever of Authors Tells All, which is like the worst written title.
Exactly. But that's, you know, when you get all these authors together and, you know, they're collaborating on things, that's what you get.
You have a signature tune with the band.
It's to make up for the fact that I don't have a good voice, so I have good costume. And
there are videos on YouTube.
Unfortunately.
Yes. Of you dressed rather provocatively. Mm-hmm. And is that a whip you're carrying?
It is. It's a cat of nine tails made out of something. Scott Turow gave that to me. So I don't take any credit.
Oh, wacky, wacky authors,
yeah,
you.
Yeah. And that song is, you know, no matter how badly I sing, suddenly I'm elevated to true rock star when I whip Stephen King in his derriere, so to speak. Yes, exactly.
The song we're talking about is These Boots Are Made for Walkin', which was recorded by Nancy Sinatra, who, all due respect, is not Frank Sinatra, you know?
No, but she has this great attitude. You know, you have almost a...
That's what you were just saying, though,
exactly.
Right? She pulls this off
pulls
through sheer
up.
Attitude.
Yeah, she does. It's very simple. Again, starts very simply. Like all the songs I picked out, they start in a simple way, and they build and have this tremendous power to the song. She was, I think, one of the first women who picked a song that had nothing to do with I'm crying because the boy left me. This one is about you treated me badly and I'm now going to beat you up for it, you know,
mm-hmm.
emotionally. I'm going to do the same thing you did to me and you are going to be sorry.
And again, not too hard to go from that song to the new book, The Valley of Amazement. You know, this character of Violet who's getting knocked down and picks herself back up and gets stronger all the time.
Yeah.
The new novel is called The Valley of Amazement. We'll hear Boots Are Made for Walking from Nancy Sinatra, picked for us by Amy Tan. Amy, it's been a while since you were last on Soundcheck. So nice to see you again. Congratulations on
the new book.
Thank
you. Good to be here.
These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Yeah.
Up next, a live performance from saxophonist and composer Matana Roberts, whose music explores her long and tangled family history. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Matana Roberts is a sax player, a singer, a band leader, but most of all, Matana Roberts is a storyteller. Maybe not in the way you'd think, but her so-called Coin Coin Project is a series of images and impressions and improvisations on the history of free people of color in the United States. It's also the story of Matana's own family, as we'll hear. She and her band are going to start things off with us with an invocation. Here's Matana Roberts and the group live on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
That is called Invocation, and it comes to us from sax player and composer and bandleader Matana Roberts, playing alto sax live here in the Soundcheck studio, with Toma Fujiwara behind our drum kit, Shoko Nagai playing our piano, and Jeremiah Abia, the operatic voice. So we have the tenor voice, the alto sax, and Matana Roberts joining me at the microphone here in our Soundcheck studio. This is from the Coin Coin Project, Chapter 2. First of all, Matana, it's great to have you back with us on Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
What is the inspiration for Coin Coin, the Coin Coin Project?
My love of American history.
Mm-hmm.
I love American history, and I kind of grew up in an environment that was very much about remembering history and understanding history as a way to understand present times and the things that you might deal with in present times. And to also be reminded to be thankful for what it is that I do have, which is so much. My mm-hmm. life is so rich.
Now, chapter one is called Gens de Couleur Libre.
Very nice, yes.
Free men of color, literally.
Yes.
The first time I ever heard that expression was many years ago, the Cajun musician Michael Doucet, mm-hmm. in sort of explaining how Cajun culture came together, said a very important part of it was free men of color.
Mm-hmm.
Who were the free men of color, and when are we talking about in American history?
Well, there are many different time periods within that of usage of that term. But for me and my family history, I'm dealing from about 1750 to 1830.
So that early?
For my people, yes.
Wow.
I do have some Cajun blood in me, mm-hmm. thanks to New Orleans, but a good portion of my people are from an area outside of Louisiana called Natchitoches. This woman, Marie-Thérèse Metoyer, was responsible for setting up this community that consisted of many free people of color. And many of the resources and experiences that I've been able to have today have a lot to do with those people and what they were able to accomplish at that time and the mores and values they passed down in my own family.
So you're able to trace your family back in this country as far back as 1750?
As 1750, yes. I cannot believe I can say that, but yes, I can say that. It's astonishing.
And so who were these people? What did they do? Where did they live? What's their story?
Most of them were land workers, business workers, people who came up through slavery, some being slaves themselves and were able to either buy themselves out of freedom or be bought out of freedom, and were able to establish businesses. Now, it's very particular that it was Louisiana that they were able to do this because some of the most bizarre racial laws were going on in Louisiana. So it's such an interesting history where people were able to get away with things in that particular state that they could not get away with elsewhere. But it also has a lot to do with the skin color. My mother, for instance, was your complexion.
Really?
So, yes. So
I'm a pretty pale guy.
Yes, my uncle is blonde hair and blue-eyed. Uh-huh. Used to get beat up all the time in the neighborhood for looking like the little white kid. Yeah.
So the idea that that these folks have been around for so long and have had such a kind of a rich history,
mm-hmm.
that gives you a great resource,
I
guess,
it gives me so much to draw on. But I come from a family that also made it a point to keep records of a lot of things got passed to me from my great-great-grandmothers. Mm. A lot of the documentation I have came from my great-great-grandmothers. And my family has always been really interested in genealogy, so I have that too, combined with my interest in history. It's just
mm-hmm. We're speaking with Matana Roberts. Her latest album is The Coin Coin Project, Chapter 2. First of all, Coin Coin, where does that come from?
So that is the nickname that this woman, Marie Metoyer, would use, was given to her supposedly by her parents. And it was the nickname that she had throughout her lifetime. I'm told that she signed that name many different ways throughout her lifetime and that it may not have, in fact, been pronounced Coin Coin. But my grandfather and his brother were were raised by people that were blood related to that woman. And so coin is how it was passed down. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather used to use that as a nickname for me as a child.
Okay. So coin chapter 2, the new album is called, subtitled, Mississippi Moonchild.
Yes.
So at some point, was your family part of the Great Migration up the Mississippi?
Yes. So I'm trying to chart my heritage out of Mississippi, Tennessee, and Louisiana. And so I do have a Mississippi side that's mostly my paternal side. That definitely were part of the Great Migration. It's why I was born in Chicago, mm-hmm. you know.
And in this piece, first of all, the album's like, there are 18 tracks, but it's one long through-composed
yes.
work. But there is a definite narrative arc.
Definitely, right. Definitely.
And the use of texts mm-hmm. and voices. Mm-hmm. There are several spirituals that are used.
Yes, in this piece in particular.
So you've got the spirituals, the blues connection, and as I say, these voices, you speak, mm-hmm. you sing, mm-hmm. and of course Jeremiah is singing in the more operatic tradition. What do all those different voices signify?
Just community and the gathering of people. I'm so interested in the way people used to sing just to sing, where it was just something that was part of a work ethic, something that was part of a day-to-day. Singing is so uplifting.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear another song. This one's called Amma Jerusalem School. It once again comes from the coin Project, Chapter 2, Mississippi Moonchild. It is the latest from Matana Roberts. She and her band are playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today.
Center of return. There are some things I just can't tell you about, honey. I step on the stage one night, my heart went pity to pat. I heard somebody say, "Oh, little pretty girl, is that?" Joshua won the battle on Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. The daffodil's steady and the lily's tall and fair. All the children love me, so why should I care? 4 months of school, 50 cents a day for chopping cotton. Sun up to sun down, honey, times was hard. Honey, times was hard. January 1949, I graduated when I was 23. Ho, dig grass, May 1949. There are some things I just can't tell you about, honey. We grew our own vegetables and Daddy quilted too, though Mama always said his stitches were too low. I sing because I'm happy, I sing because I'm free. His eyes on the sparrow and I know he watches over me.
Thank you.
That, once again, is Matana Roberts and her quartet performing live in the Soundcheck studio. The song is called Amma Jerusalem School. Brief quote of His Eye is on the Sparrow in
yes,
the
that's
middle
one
of that.
My favorite.
Part of her Coin Coin project, Chapter 2, the album subtitled Mississippi Moonchild. It is out now. Matana Roberts and her band playing for us here on Soundcheck today. Thank you very much. Great to see you again.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
There's more where this came from, including more music. You can hear the full session with Matana Roberts on soundcheck.org. On the show Monday, as the world gears up for the Sochi Olympics, we'll hear about what's hot in the world of Russian pop music. Plus, live music from the New Orleans country folk band called Hooray for the Riffraff. They'll play songs from a new album called Small Town Heroes. We'll get an intimate live performance of some of those new songs Monday on Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Have a great weekend.